Hello, hello everybody. This is Dr. Aaron Stair, Dr. Eeks, as some of you know me. Someone asked me recently where that came from. It's actually a nickname from medical school. Someone called me Eeks and then just added doctor to it, and I don't know, it seemed fitting, so I stuck with it. Anyhow, this is another episode of Causes or Cures. Writers, poets, songwriters, musicians, artists create some of their best work because they are inspired by what it feels like to have a broken heart. Probably some of their creation, all of it, is therapeutic to them, so they're compelled to do it. It's something we are all going to experience. I mean, if we love, we will also experience loss and a broken heart. So we look to poems, songs, books to help us through. Of course, when we talk about broken hearts, being heartbroken, having a heart that's breaking, we're not talking about it in the literal sense. We're talking about how we feel. But did you know that there is an actual medical condition called broken heart syndrome? And it actually changes the way the heart looks and functions. And if you're not careful, it can be deadly. Joining me today is cardiologist and researcher Dr. Antonio Abate, who has researched this topic. He's seen many patients with it. He's going to tell us what broken heart syndrome is, who is at risk, when it happens, how you recognize it, how you treat it, and what the prognosis looks like. Like, if you have broken heart syndrome, are you at risk of getting it again? You know, I find this topic fascinating because it really shows how the heart is the center of emotion in a really tangible way. Anyhow, I won't go full Hallmark on you because, frankly, I can't write for Hallmark. I'm too sarcastic for that. But I find it fascinating, and it's probably true for animals too. Any creature out there with a heart. So, and it kind of really, you know, just makes all those poems and songs and conversations just more real. I don't know. Anyhow, let's get Dr. Abate on the line and learn about broken heart syndrome. Anyhow, this is cool. I really appreciate you doing this on a Sunday morning. But it's a neat topic. So I guess
I appreciate it because I think there's, you know, lots of awareness to be raised about this. So
yeah, definitely. So I guess for starters, just so people know that, you know, you're not just someone coming off the street to do this, could you just say who you are and the type of work and research you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Antonio Abate. I'm a cardiologist at the Virginia Commonwealth University. I've been doing research in the field of cardiovascular medicine for about 20 years. I'm also the medical director for the clinical research unit here. Completed my training in Italy at the Catholic University of Rome and then joined VCU maybe 15 years ago.
Okay, awesome.
Okay. Was that good enough?
Yeah, no, that was perfect. That was perfect. All right. So, you know, you often hear people say so-and-so died of a broken heart. You also hear my heart is broken. My heart is breaking. And, you know, like those statements kind of, they're not to be taken literally. They're there to express how we feel, human emotions. Yet there is an actual syndrome called broken heart syndrome. And hopefully I say this right. Is it Takotsubo? Sort of.
Yeah, I don't know what the right pronunciation is. It's it's derived from the Japanese language. I pronounce it Takotsubo.
Takotsubo. Okay. I knew I was going to massacre that pronunciation, but Anyways, can you explain what this syndrome is in kind of an easy to understand way?
Yes, absolutely. So in the kind of culture and general knowledge, there's this concept that someone can have a broken heart and die from it. And maybe it comes from mythology books and movies. And this idea that events that affect your mind have a consequence of your heart has been known for decades, or probably centuries, has been studied in some disciplines that affect the brain as a structure and as a function. However, a turning point in this has been approximately 15 to 20 years ago, when a group of researchers have been systematically describing a pattern of cardiac dysfunction that has a specific shape, and I'll tell you in a second, and connecting this with a stressor that had happened in the patients in the days preceding the event. And when these investigators, researchers, or clinicians starting to report this systematically, I think most of us that were practicing already or finishing training realized that this wasn't really new. This is something that we had known about it, but hadn't really classified it, hadn't really put it together, hadn't given a name. Should I?
Interesting.
Yeah, and I'm happy to expand a little bit more on that. And
Well,
go ahead.
yeah. So, you know, and I've read a little bit on this. There's not really a lot as far as I can tell, but they talk about both physical and emotional triggers. And like you said, it happens 1 to 5 days before the syndrome presents. So can you talk about some of those triggers and if there are ones that are more common than others?
Yes, and if you allow me, I'll go back a little bit in
Yeah.
what we knew even before this syndrome was characterized as a stress cardiomyopathy or Tachycardia.
Sure.
What we knew already before was that patients that were having some sort of brain injury or brain event, like a massive stroke due to a bleeding in the head, or they were having incessant seizures, or patients that were undergoing electrical stimulation therapy for depression, for example. In some cases, some of these patients would present 1 or 2 days later with abnormalities, first in the EKG, and then were captured also in the biomarkers. And if you look for it, you would see it also on the echocardiogram or imaging of the cardiac function. And most importantly, we know that those patients who are suffering from a significant brain event, even a simple stroke, are at increased risk of having an adverse cardiac event like an arrhythmic event. So this link between the brain injury, brain dysfunction, and the heart has been known for decades in the medical literature. What was not really understood was that this stressor did not need to be a physical stressor to the brain, an injury to the brain. It could be an emotional one. This was, I think, it was a little bit of a surprise to the field, but allowed us to re-explore a whole sort of different conditions where the link was maybe not as apparent before.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So in terms of these like emotional triggers, are there some that are more common than others?
Absolutely. So the classic trigger, the one that was initially described and the one that you would be looking for when we started looking, thinking about patients with this syndrome, would be the loss of a family member, usually of either a life partner or a child. And it would be the grieving process, especially if unexpected, associated with a sense of despair that is often associated with grieving. This is the classic stressor described in this syndrome, and the classic subject at risk would be a woman that is a little bit older in their age and postmenopausal, and these are going to be risk factor for this syndrome.
Yeah, and I wrote down some questions about without those, specifically, the sex difference. But in general, so, I've read like there's catecholamines involved. It might be hormones involved. What is the latest thought process on how this occurs, the mechanism of action?
Yes. So there's much research is still needed. What we know is that catecholamines, which are these hormones produced during stress, and it can be released both by your adrenal glands and by your nerve endings, are elevated in levels during an episode of stress cardiomyopathy or Takotsubo. However, I would say that these are insufficient to explain the entire syndrome because there are other conditions where the levels are equally elevated and we don't see the syndrome. So just having elevated levels of catecholamines is not sufficient to explain the syndrome. It's possibly a part of it. I think, and many others that study this disease think that the way that these mediators are released is very important. And so it's likely the effect of the catecholamines released directly by the nerve endings in the heart that may mediate this syndrome rather than just elevated levels in the plasma. And there's likely a combination of multiple mediators that are released simultaneously by this nerve ending. One of them that is been studied more is called neuropeptide Y. This neuropeptide is one of the many other neurotransmitter or mediators in the brain that regulate different aspects of our brain function. And they can also be produced in the brain and released into the heart. And I will re-say that other than they can, they're routinely, this neurotransmitter is produced in the brain and it's released to nerve endings in different organs, including the heart. And so in a specific condition or situation where there may be an excessive, inappropriate, deregulated production of neurotransmitters or hormones in the brain that are now released in excess to a specific part of the heart, this may be sufficient to induce the syndrome.
Wow, that's really interesting. Just in terms of thinking about, just like how your emotions have that much power. So if somebody has this, I would imagine they'd have to go to the ER. So what are the types of symptoms that you see?
Yes. So, as you can imagine, in biology, we can expect that there is a spectrum of severity of this syndrome. And so, it could be that many experience very mild symptoms, and that could be just a little bit of shortness of breath and maybe fatigue, And it may be minor, may not interfere with their well-being, and it may subside by itself without needing to do anything. And probably for every patient that gets the more severe form, the one that, let's say, puts the patients at jeopardy, there must be many more that have a milder form that just goes away. And I wouldn't be surprised if we found that many of the people that are kind of struggling with grieving and not feeling well may have some mild form of this that's just going away, and they just feel wore down after a significant stress. They feel tired, they feel like they don't feel like themselves. It could be part of this in a very mild form. The ones who are putting their have their a higher risk, they usually have a more profound effect on their cardiac function. In that case, the main symptoms is shortness of breath. They're having trouble having a good deep breath, and sometimes having trouble laying down on in the bed because the fluid will accumulate in their lungs, having trouble doing simple tasks like walking or going up the stairs. Chest pain is also common at about two-thirds of the people. It can present as heaviness or actual pain. It can simulate a heart attack. So often we see patients with stress cardiomyopathy in the emergency department as they're being evaluated for a possible heart attack. In a minority of cases, the presentation doesn't really have these acute symptoms, and it's more of hypotension leading to syncope, so passing out, dizziness. And that's less likely, but it's also possible.
So that's interesting. So you think maybe that, people who are grieving, they experience loss of a loved one, maybe a breakup, of a significant relationship, they might experience this syndrome, but not enough to make them go to the doctor or the hospital, and then the syndrome resolves. So there might be a bunch of these out there that you're just not picking up, right? They're not, being sort of systematically gathered or put into a database. Is that so?
I would imagine so. I mean, every time that you have in biology, you have an event, a biological event, you would expect that the distribution of the severity follows a curve that we would call like a Gaussian curve or a normal distribution, where you would have that. For there's going to be a majority of patients who have a certain amount of severity of symptoms, but for that majority of patients with those symptoms, there has to be another group of patients who have milder symptoms that you may not be able to even capture. And then we would have those on the left side of the curve, and then you would have another chunk of patients that have the more severe, the most severe life-threatening form of this disease on the right side of the curve. And so I anticipate this would happen. I mean, having had episodes of loss and grieving in my life, I'd say that it is pretty common, I think, to experience that sense of extreme fatigue and even kind of real heartache. That the one describes. Now, I'm not saying that everybody is having a stress cardiomyopathy after an intense stressor, but there may be that some of the symptoms you're feeling are real, meaning that those are sensations that are generated from your brain talking with your heart and making you feel something in your chest. And it's not, it's likely not a play of chance that poets and writers will look at, will hint at the heart as a place for where the emotions are. So there's likely a strong connection there. Now, when does it actually become a disease? I guess it becomes a disease when this interferes with your well-being. So if you're not able to function, if you're not able, you know, this discomfort you're experiencing is impeding you to walk, is making you feel dizzy, or it's real pain, you should consider this may be happening. You may be having an event related to a stress in the heart.
Okay, so along those lines, someone goes to the ER, you said it presents, you know, they often think they're having a heart attack, same kind of symptoms. How do you differentiate between this and a heart attack? That's my first question. And then what treatment would you recommend or do?
Yes. So very good. So the differentiation between the two can be tricky and many times requires multiple tests. The stress cardiomyopathy often presents with the similar symptoms as we talked about, and abnormal EKG. That's the test that looks at electrical activity of the heart. And so when the EKG is obtained, it is common that the emergency department or the cardiology system is activated or alerted as a possible heart attack. And sometimes the patient will need to go even urgently or emergently to the do other tests to exclude the possibility that a heart attack is actually ongoing, like a coronary angiogram, where dye is injected in the coronary arteries to exclude that there's a blockage. That will depend on how the EKG looks. Biomarker are also often used, and these are blood tests that look at injury to the heart. And there are specific biomarkers for the heart that are abnormal during heart attacks. Those tests are often abnormal, even in stress cardiomyopathy, although usually to a lesser degree, and therefore can be difficult to differentiate. What is unique or characteristic about the stress cardiomyopathy is that when you look at the heart through an imaging test, being an echocardiography or a magnetic resonance imaging, or during the angiogram, you look at also at the left ventricle, you notice that there are regions of the heart that contract in an abnormal way. They don't squeeze properly, and they have a distribution that does not fit one of the heart attack. And therefore, that unique distribution or pattern of distribution, there are a few of them, it provides a strong suggestion that that could be a stress cardiomyopathy. That's where the name Takotsubo comes from, because Takotsubo, for at least what I'm told, because I don't speak Japanese, but what I'm told is a pot used to catch octopi in the sea. And so the shape of this pot is such that it has a narrow neck and then a wide base. Mm. And so the octopi would go inside and get stuck inside the pot. And when the classic form of the stress cardiomyopathy or Takotsubo is one where one part of the heart at the base squeezes very well, actually sometimes even more than normal, and so it's very narrow. Mm. And the apex of the heart, that would be the base of the pot, is actually not squeezing at all, and it's ballooning out. Mm-hmm. And it's also called as apical ballooning syndrome. This is reported in up to 85% of cases. When you see that that form, that pattern on your imaging, your probability of having a stress cardiomyopathy versus a heart attack is much, much higher.
Mm. Interesting. So what would you do in terms of treatment? You see that image, you write down the diagnosis. How would you treat it?
So the good news is it goes away by itself. So you wait long enough and it goes away. And usually, by definition, to be sure that this is a stress cardiomyopathy, it needs to be induced by a stress that I actually did not mention. Sometimes we cannot identify what the stress is, but it needs to start at some point and it needs to resolve within 3 weeks. If it doesn't resolve, then that suggests that that was not the right diagnosis. Something else may be going on. In the
So,
meantime, sorry, go ahead.
oh no, go ahead, go ahead.
In the meantime, the patient may need some treatments for those 3 weeks in some cases. In some cases, is the form is rather mild and no real treatment is necessary. And the patient may be in observation for a short period of time. In some other cases, there are significant abnormality in your EKG and in your imaging that show that a large area of the heart is not contracting. That puts the heart at risk of forming a clot. And therefore, one of the treatments that we recommend for patients with large area of forming a clot in the heart is to be on blood thinners to prevent the clot formation. And that should continue until the contractility is restored, until that area of contraction loss is resolved.
So a person, so they don't always have to be, in inpatient. You're not monitoring them like that closely.
So most of the patients will spend one day or more in the hospital because most of them present with something that looks like a heart attack. They have abnormal cardiac markers, and we usually observe them to exclude one other complication that I briefly mentioned earlier, which is arrhythmias, abnormal heart rhythm that can be life-threatening. So there are risk markers for arrhythmias. One of them is the prolongation of the QT on the EKG. So we like to keep the patient until the QT has normalized or at least is not markedly prolonged.
So if you send people home, do you give them, I mean, so someone goes home with a diagnosis of broken heart syndrome or stress cardiomyopathy. I'm not sure how you write it down, but do you tell them to just continue to go about their day to day or to avoid certain things?
So we if someone goes home with that diagnosis, we usually bring them back within a time frame of 3 weeks or less to document that the cardiomyopathy is resolved and normalized the function. There are a minority of cases that have a very grave outcome in the hospital, meaning they have complications from this, meaning that the dysfunction is so severe and the way that the contraction is altered in the apex and normal at the base and can create an obstruction in the heart that some patients require to be on mechanical support for their heart and or they have trouble maintaining normal pressures in the heart and they develop acute heart failure and require to make treatment for the heart failure and sometimes even support for their respiration with oxygen therapy or even mechanical ventilation. Most of the patients don't experience this, but sometimes we don't know as they arrive and we keep them for a few days. And we may need to treat the patients for volume overload with diuretics if they're accumulating fluid. There is potential benefit of a beta adrenergic blocker in some cases to reduce the potential for creating an obstruction in the heart if there's a, if that's seen at imaging, and I mentioned the anticoagulation.
Right,
after,
right.
Yeah, after that, when the patient is recovered and going home, many ask, why did that happen? And, you know, will it happen again? Unfortunately, the data is accumulating that patients who have had it will have and will at, be at risk for recurrence. And so this is certainly that that it's certainly possible. And they're probably going to be more aware of this after they had it the first time. And so they'll be easier to diagnose. And so we've had patients who have had multiple episodes in their life. What can they do to prevent that? Medications have been proposed, but they're not unanimously shown to help in any way. One of the medications that has been proposed is the use of a beta adrenergic blocker, but again, hasn't been shown in clinical trials to make a difference. And so we use it case by case, looking if the patient has other indications or other, or if it would affect other side, you know, if the patient would be able to tolerate the potential side effect of the medication.
I can't imagine that being like a, having your heart break literally multiple times, like, gosh. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the differences in biological women and men. Like you said earlier, most people worldwide are women, they're postmenopausal women. I think I did read that men were more likely to die, which you can correct me if that's wrong. But is there any idea why this difference exists between the sexes?
Yeah, so there's definitely a higher prevalence of predominance of women in the in this syndrome, and there's several different possibilities of why that could be. One is that the makeup of the neurotransmitters in the brain that may cause this dysfunction in the heart, and they're still being characterized, they're likely influenced by sexual hormones. And therefore, it's thought that there's a change in the pattern of these neurotransmitters, especially in the postmenopausal woman. That's one theory. The second theory is that the heart structure needs to be also vulnerable to react to these neurotransmitters. And postmenopausal women are known to be at risk for having what we call microvascular dysfunction, which is a condition where the heart vessels are normal in size, and there's in they don't have any blockages, but they don't react as they should to need for vasodilatation. So they are not, they don't have the normal reserve when it's needed during exercise, and this is a common cause of chest pain in women. We call this microvascular dysfunction. And so this could be another reason why this is more common in postmenopausal women. Now, both of these cocktail of neurotransmitters and the microvascular dysfunction are not, they don't occur only in women. Also, a man obviously can have microvascular dysfunction. And I'm sure that there are other factors that regulate the neurotransmitters in the brain. One final comment would be that there could be also a diagnostic bias here, meaning that since the initial description of this syndrome was in a postmenopausal woman, there could be a bias by which doctors are more inclined to diagnose this in a postmenopausal woman, and they're more likely to diagnose the same syndrome in a man that is middle age with maybe a diagnosis of a heart attack, even if it doesn't fit well, just because they may be biased by the way the syndrome has been portrayed.
Got it. Interesting. Now, is there a link at all to having an underlying mental pathology?
Right. So we'll have to say yes, but with some caveats. As I explained, there's a lot of research still going on here, and I think we need to make sure we say that over and over again because we want to learn more about this condition
Right.
here. As I mentioned earlier, the stressor that the classic stressor has. It is, the loss of a loved one is only present in some cases or is only identifiable in some cases. Now, this history recalling is not a perfect science because it depends on two major factors. The person who's taking the history and the subject who's giving the history. And so there could be, again, bias in asking the question and bias in recalling the questions as well.
Right.
And so the one thing that we've learned is that the stressor does not have to be the absolutely that catastrophic as the death of a loved one. There have been now hundreds and hundreds of reports of Takotsubo, and some of them have been related to events or stressors that many would consider mild or trivial or minor. And they go from having an argument at work or being upset others to having being involved in a minor car accident, but without getting hurt. So just the scare of that. I have one slide that I show in my presentation. It's kind of funny. It was on social media that a woman mistaken wasabi for avocado and just ate a bunch of wasabi and apparently had Takotsubo afterwards. So,
I can see that happening, frankly.
as you can understand, the stressor can be variable. Now, the person who's recalling the incident now, if I ask you, if you came in today with and you were diagnosed with this syndrome, and I ask you what happened in the past, did anything happen in the past 5 days? Unless you had a death of a loved one, you may say, well, nothing happened. And you may not be willing to share with me, and you may not be particularly bothered by it, but maybe, psychologically it did affect you and you're not able to verbalize it or communicate it. So that goes back to maybe there's a difference between women and men in the way they elaborate the stress and the way they communicate it. Maybe women are elaborating, communicating better. I don't know. That's one possibility. So there is definitely an increased prevalence of, and I'm sorry, it's a very long answer, but there's an increased predominance of individuals with a diagnosis of anxiety, depression, and schizophrenia among those who are diagnosed with stress cardiomyopathy. Whether this is a cause-effect link, I cannot say for sure, but definitely increases the likelihood.
Right. And I think too, there is a bias just in women being diagnosed more with anxiety and depression.
Correct.
So I read the one of the case studies that you authored with a couple other people about, which I thought it was interesting because it was about a 23-year-old woman. So she's young and she had this syndrome, and her stressor that was reported that she just left an abusive relationship with her husband. I believe it was her husband. But it also said that she had a long history of smoking cigarettes and marijuana. So, and I tried to find to see if there was a relationship there. Is there, are those two things, tobacco use and marijuana use, possible risk factors for this?
Yeah. So I remember that case, you know, distinctly. There was a, you know, tragic, tragic case. And if you'll allow me, I'll tell you a little bit about the psychology of that case. This young woman, this is, I mean, unfortunately, I didn't get the history from her because when she arrived in the hospital, she was already unconscious. But after getting more of the history from the family, what the understanding was is that she had been in some sort of an abusive relationship, and she had felt threatened, and she had to leave her place and go stay at another family member, kind of to avoid this person. So that kind of stress that you fear for your life can certainly be a significant stressor. I didn't tell you about preclinical experiments in animals, but some of this can be reproduced in animal models by inducing some sort of fear. And so that's certainly one common. In this young lady, when she arrived, we struggled to understand what was going on with her. And because she didn't fit our profile, you know, she wasn't a postmenopausal woman. She didn't have the loss of a loved one the days before. And also, I mentioned earlier that the typical pattern is the one that affects the apex of the heart. However, in some cases, especially in the young, especially when the stressor is not typical, it can affect other parts of the heart. It makes it a little more difficult to identify. And when we were looking at why would this young woman have this this presentation, the only risk factor we could find was that she had been a cannabis user. And there are reports now that are coming out that cannabis users, as well as amphetamine and cocaine users, are more represented among Takotsubo patients, and they have worse outcomes. So I have to be, you know, I have to be careful in saying that that caused it, because it would be very difficult to show causality. However, there is a lot of literature linking cannabis use disorder when subjects are having possibly some addiction or anxiety generated related to the cannabis use, and the activation of brain regions that are very similar to the ones that we see abnormal in patients with Takotsubo. So it is certainly a possible link that we would be, that we're concerned about, and we want to make people aware, and we want to study more.
That's so interesting. You know, because I just, when you think about people smoking, you know, marijuana, it's like they do it to relax, but here it might be a risk factor. It's just interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not an expert, but in the group here at VCU is doing a lot of research in this. And what they tell me is that, you know, the response is very different among individuals and is actually not unusual to have an anxiety response after initial pleasant response. There can be a rebound anxiety response. And so that could be one of the triggers that pushes individuals to use more, but that could also activate patterns that are not possibly not beneficial.
That's interesting. Like almost like a chemical dependency type of thing.
It would be something like that. And again, I'm going to have to defer to the specialist.
Yeah. Interesting. So I wanted to ask specifically about asthma. I got diagnosed with asthma and I have my, you know, of course, my rescue inhaler that I take with me wherever I go. So beta 2 agonist, right? You know, are those, is that a risk factor for this syndrome?
Yeah, so beta 2 agonists are not a risk factor, or not that we know, but a diagnosis of asthma is. Hmm. And I guess, again, what we cannot say that asthma is causing this directly, but there is an association between asthma, COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and more Takotsubo. And that is puzzling, but one of the possibility is that some of these neurotransmitters that are involved in Takotsubo are also involved in the pathophysiology of these other syndromes. So going back to whether what's causing what, it is possible that you as a patient with asthma have a predisposition to asthma, as well as a predisposition to this syndrome. Again, it's only a possibility at this point.
Right, right. I've heard so many different theories about asthma too. So I figured that it's hard to, there's probably chicken and egg relationships too, that have yet to come to light.
I would like to reassure you and everybody else that, you know, this syndrome is still rare. I mean, the 99.99% of people every day have major stressors, including the death of loved ones, and they don't experience this syndrome. So this is not the rule. This is the exception. The rule is there is connection between the brain and the heart. The exception is that this connection becomes so abnormal and intense that can make you become symptomatic and have an abnormal heart function. But there is no reason to think that this is going to happen to you just because you have asthma.
Right, right, right. Hopefully it won't. Thank you so much. This was all so interesting and I learned so much, so I want to thank you for your time. My last question here has to do kind of, I guess, with the difference between chronic stress and acute stress on the heart or on the brain heart connection. You see a lot of focus today, you know, prevention and wellness on these chronic stress reduction programs. Would something like that be of benefit here, or is this stressor something that's just so acute, so painful that, you know, these types of programs, you know, addressing chronic stress and the effects that stress has on the body, would that be of benefit at all?
Well, you know, you're asking something that's not exactly in my expertise. However, you know, I work with a group of psychiatrists and psychologists that are interested in this. And if I were to paraphrase what they tell me is that likely the individuals that suffer from this syndrome, and especially if they have suffered before, but even before the first event, they may have an abnormal coping mechanism to negative events. And there's some research showing that, you know, there are functional MRI studies that show that when individuals with Takotsubo are shown negative emotion triggers, they cope worse than, not worse, but differently than others, or have less favorable coping mechanisms. And so I think that if one were able to develop better coping mechanisms to adversity, that would certainly diminish the stress. And I would think that would help prevent these events. But I cannot quote you a specific clinical trial that has shown that.
Yeah. No, I was just curious about that. But I guess, you know, what I learned from this, that it's rare, but it is possible that you can get a broken heart and you can even die from a broken heart.
Yep, unfortunately, it is possible there. One other question that I get all the time is, I'm stressed all the time. Is that what's causing it? Should I come in to get checked out? Well, again, as you pointed out, this is not the chronic stress that, you don't have a chronic stress cardiomyopathy. That there may be a different condition. Chronic stress may be harmful for other reasons, but that this is not what we're talking about. And yes, unfortunately, people can die from this. And so if you know, if it is rare. Most of people do just fine when they have an adverse event. But if you think that you're hurting and you're not feeling well and you may be suffering from this, you need to be checked out. You need to come to the emergency room or call 911.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That was really interesting. And I look forward to sharing this and hearing what people have to say.
Yeah, let me know.
I will absolutely. I'll send you a copy when I publish it on the podcast for sure.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thanks so much and enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Yeah, I'm on call today, so
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully it's a slow day.
I'm getting a lot of snow too. I don't know. Where are you located?
Oh, yeah, I'm in New York City.
I think
So
coming tomorrow for you, I guess.
maybe, yeah, it's coming tomorrow. I just scheduled, I haven't had my hair cut in like 6 months. So I was like, I'm gonna go do that this afternoon. I'm just gonna throw on
Sounds
a
great.
mask and so that's what I'm doing this afternoon.
Keep up the good work. I love your blogs. Really good job.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Okay, bye-bye. Never give all the heart, for love will hardly seem worth thinking of to passionate women if it seem certain, and they never dream that it fades out from kiss to kiss, for everything that's lovely is but a brief, dreamy, kind delight. Oh, never give the heart outright, for they, for all smooth lips can say, have given their hearts up to the play. And who could play it well enough if deaf and dumb and blind with love? He that made this knows all the cost, for he gave all his heart and lost. Huh. That's actually one of my favorite poems by one of my favorite poets, William Butler Yeats. And guys, what are the chances of him not having at least one bout of broken heart syndrome? I mean, right? Or perhaps he didn't get it because he channeled all of those emotions and hormones or whatever into writing poetry and his art. So we got all these great poems and his heart didn't end up looking like an octopus trap. Of course, he's Irish. So, the Irish always have broken hearts. I'm Irish. We're kind of born with a broken heart. That's why we're known for great poetry and being alcoholics. Anyways, all right, guys, thanks for listening. I hope you share this podcast, subscribe, stick around for more causes or cures episodes in the future. Until then, stay healthy and content. All right, bye.